Welcome to the Locked Room. Stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mardell. And this week we have a story by E. Phillips Oppenheim, The Salving of Mr. Stanley Witt. At last, Nicholas Goad was happily situated. He had escaped altogether from the atmosphere of tragedy and gloom, and sat upon his camp stool, painting contentedly upon the common adjoining a picturesque village in mid-Devonshire, whose whitewashed cottages with their fragrant, color-splashed gardens, snug homesteads, and ample population of pleasant-voiced, apple-cheeked maidens, matrons, and kindly-mannered seniors, all betokened an ease of living and happy day-by-day life, soothing to the senses and restful to the nerves. It was a land of green meadows, trout streams, and peace, where nobody seemed to have anything to do and plenty of time to do it in. Flip was seated upon her haunches by his side, snapping at flies, and an elderly gentleman, leaning upon a stick, watched his work with puckered lips and a frown upon his forehead. "Fond of this sort of thing, sir?" Goad presently asked his uninvited companion. "Not the way you're doing it," was the frank reply. Goad swung around upon his camp stool at this unexpected criticism. He saw a rather undersized, elderly gentleman, neatly dressed in country clothes, with sensitive features and a not unkindly mouth, a man apparently of about 60 years of age. Accustomed to classifying people on sight, Goad would have put him down as a retired professional man. "You don't like my little effort?" he queried.
"I think it's horrible," was the prompt response.
"I have been standing here wondering why a grown man like you, a man with a not unintelligent face, should waste his time in such a fashion." Goad looked dubiously at the awful daub which he had perpetrated and back again at his critic. "But I like doing it," he confided. "It amuses me." "If it amuses you, that's a different matter," the elderly gentleman admitted, leaning a little more heavily upon his stick. "You may thank your stars you don't have to do it for a living. I'm not a gambler, but I would wager that you have never sold one of your productions in your life."
"You are quite right," Goad acquiesced. "I keep them to decorate my studio." The little gentleman shivered. "What a nightmare of a place it must be," he commented.
12:30 sounded from the church clock on the other side of the common. Goad covered up the canvas and prepared for departure. "In my time," he acknowledged, "I have become hardened to criticism. My work, as a matter of fact, does not find favor with everyone. At the same time, if I may be permitted to say so, I have never yet met a stranger who has expressed himself quite so forcibly."
"Then you've been lucky," was the dry retort. "I am something of an artist myself, and I assure you that it is a positive pain to me to contemplate murderous efforts like yours. I abhor all forms of ugliness. I look upon the man who brings into the world of actual things a daub such as you have just become responsible for as a criminal, nothing less than a criminal."
"You depress me exceedingly," Goad sighed. "Nevertheless," he went on, casting another and more searching glance at his new friend, "I am quite sure that your frankness is not meant to be offensive. I am now on my way back to the inn. Do me the favor of drinking a glass of sherry with me." The old gentleman gripped his stick firmly and prepared to accompany his companion.
"On condition," he said, "that you assure me upon your word of honor that not a penny of such income as you may be in enjoyment of comes from dealing in any fashion with your outrageous work. I will accept your hospitality with pleasure."
"I can offer you that assurance with a clear conscience,"
Goad told him. They strolled across the common side by side, conversing indifferently upon general topics. The little old gentleman was interested in his companion, and to a less extent, Goad reciprocated the sentiment. Living in a small neighborhood, the former said, one develops a vein of curiosity as to strangers with whom one is brought into contact. I have lived here for 27 years, and I have become as local as the geese, the postmistress, and the vicar. I'm curious about you, sir. What might your profession be?
Just at present, Goad confided, I am resting. I have come into quite a considerable sum of money from a certain enterprise with which I was connected, and I am endeavoring to take a holiday.
I see, the old gentleman murmured. And your name?
Nicholas Goad.
Mine is Stanley Witt, Mr. Stanley Witt. I am a retired dealer in curios, second-hand books, ivories, bronzes, and jewelry. Was this enterprise of which you speak a commercial one?
Goad reflected for a moment. The tracking down through 12 weary months of Ned Bullivant, the greatest criminal New York had ever turned loose upon the world, could scarcely come under such a heading.
Not exactly, he admitted. I scarcely know what you would call it. The sort of thing that comes to a man once in a lifetime.
They entered the low portals of the Chidford Arms, descended a step, and turned towards the comfortable bar parlor. Mr. Witt laid his hand upon his companion's arm.
For God's sake, don't bring that truck inside, he begged. Someone might ask to look at your work, and another glance at it before I have lunched would ruin my appetite.
Goad unburdened himself and laid his easel and canvas against the wall.
If you go on like this, he grumbled good-naturedly, I shall begin to lose confidence in myself.
The sooner the better, was the eager response. I think you said that you were on a motor tour.
Try fishing. You'll find a stream anywhere around here. Fishing is a reasonable hobby, better even than a bag of golf clubs strapped on behind than that horrible paraphernalia of yours.
They entered the inn parlor, fairly full at that hour of the morning. Goad was greeted with the reserved cordiality accorded to strangers, whilst Mr. Witt, on the other hand, was welcomed enthusiastically. The former, standing a little apart, was able to gauge a nicety, his companion's social position, by the nature of the salutations he received. The butcher, the manager from the grocer's shop, and the saddler were cordial but respectful. The doctor, the bank manager, and the prosperous-looking farmer greeted him with friendly equality. Obviously, he had established himself as the humorist of the place and an original. More than once his sallies produced little peals of laughter, when, after having returned the compliment of the glass of sherry, he took his leave, and most of the others followed him.
If you've 10 minutes to spare before you go away, were his parting words to Nicholas Goad, and if you really want to know something about the great art of painting, and call round at my little house, and I'll show you a landscape which should make you want to destroy every atrocity you have ever perpetrated. Any evening, any time after 7.
I'll look in with pleasure, Goad promised.
Mr. Witt had scarcely reached the street before he became the subject of conversation amongst the diminished company left behind in the bar parlor.
It do seem a wonderful thing and a great pleasure, the landlady declared, to see him almost himself again. It's the first time for a week he squashed the threshold, and him the most regular of all my customers.
It was ordained that always he should take his glass of sherry at 12:15, a farmer remarked.
"Has Mr. Witt been ill?" Goad inquired. The farmer shook his head, the landlady sighed. The saddler and harness-maker in the corner looked gloomily upon the floor. They all hesitated.
"He do seem to have met with trouble, has Mr. Witt," the landlady confided, turning away as she spoke with the air of one who has finished the subject.
There was a mystery about Mr. Witt. that Goad gathered easily enough during the next few days from the landlady and the little crowd of bar loungers who were only too ready to discuss him. But what that mystery might be, no one seemed to know. A little more than a fortnight previously, he had apparently met with trouble of some undefined sort, and now, without warning or explanation, he was subject to fits of isolation, during which no one saw or heard anything of him. There were rumors of cases full of his most precious possessions being sent away by rail to Exeter and even to London. At such moments, as the conversation touched, however vaguely, upon financial matters, the bank manager, whose lips were sealed by etiquette, retired from the conversation into a gloomy and portentous silence. In the end, Goad became interested. He found himself speculating often as to the cause of Mr. Witt's trouble, to see looming up before him the shadow of that crime, in the detection of which he had first won his spurs, the crime of blackmail. He would have made an attempt to gain the little man's confidence, but day after day passed without a further visit from him. Finally, after dinner one night at the Chidford Arms, a dinner of roast veal and bacon, raspberry tart, and Stilton cheese, Flip and her master, equally satisfied with their fare, made their way up the village street and climbed the hill towards the few private residences upon its crest, the second of which had been pointed out to him as the abode of Mr. Witt. For 5 days now the latter had been invisible, and curiously enough, Goad himself, as well as the habitués of the Chidford Arms, had missed the little man's genial presence, his caustic remarks, his humorous sallies. He had apparently gone into retreat, and any reference to him or to his affairs had been met with blank silence. Even Goad, whose sensibilities in such matters had become blunted, felt guilty almost of intrusion as he rang the shining doorbell. For several moments, nothing happened. Then a trim little maidservant of tender years opened the door and peered out. "I should like to see Mr. Witt," Goad announced. The maidservant looked doubtful. "I don't think he'll see, sir," she replied. "He's none too grand, isn't Mr. Witt, and he's busy." "You might inquire," Goad persisted. "He asked me to come. I won't keep him long." The little maidservant departed reluctantly, leaving Goad in a small but cosily furnished hall, redeemed from mediocrity by a wonderful Georgian grandfather's clock and a Chippendale table upon which was a rose bowl of Nankin china. She was absent 2 or 3 minutes, at the end of which a door on the ground floor suddenly opened and Mr. Witt looked out. He was collarless and his hands were dusty. He carried in his hand a hammer. "What do you want?" he asked sharply. "I called to have a look at your picture," Goad explained. "If you remember, you offered to show it to me." "I've been a little discouraged with my own work the last few days." "Discouraged? I should think so," was the acid rejoinder. "I can't show you my picture tonight. I'm too busy. I'll come again in a week or so." "But, my dear sir," Goad protested, "I shan't be here in a week or so. I'm just a tourist. I may move on tomorrow or the next day." "And paint more pictures?" Mr. Witt inquired with a shudder. "And paint more pictures," Goad acquiesced. "I have finished quite a good one, with the church tower in the distance and the geese on the common. Wonderful foreground the geese make. I thought of going south and trying to get the coloring of the moors." Mr. Witt shivered. "Come in," he invited abruptly, standing away from the door. Goad accepted the invitation and entered an unexpectedly large and pleasant-looking apartment in a state of great disorder. There were 2 packing cases upon the floor, one of which was half filled with books and a number of statuettes carefully wrapped up in paper. There were empty spaces upon the walls, in the bookcases, and upon the brackets. Mr. Witt took his visitor by the arm and led him to a small canvas hanging in a recess, a landscape, deep and rich in coloring. "That's the real thing," he pointed out. "I don't suppose it's much use talking to you about it. I should think you know about as much of art as my little maid of all work. Now consider for a moment that grouping and perspective. If you were to attempt to paint cows that size, you'd have them traveling out of the canvas. Look at the beauty of the coloring, too, the slant of that rain on the horizon. So faint one might call it no more than a suggestion, and yet, if you analyze it, there it all is. I dare say you don't appreciate it, but if you looked at it long enough and often enough, you'd probably end by throwing your palette away. I know enough to realize that it is a very wonderful picture," Goad admitted. "You have other interesting things, too. That, for instance, is a beautiful bronze." "It ought to be," Mr. Witt acknowledged. "I gave £90 for it as a dealer at the Exford sale."
"And you are now parting with it?" Goad remarked, glancing at the half-empty case and taking his courage into both hands. "Why?"
"That is my business," was the curt reply. Uninvited, Goad sank into an easy chair. "Can I stay for a quarter of an hour?" he asked. "I should like to smoke a cigarette with you, if I may."
"I am expecting a visitor," Mr. Witt said dubiously.
"Oh, my staying need not interfere with him. When he comes, I will go."
"But I don't want you here when he comes."
Mr. Goad showed no signs of moving. "Mr. Witt," he said, "on our first meeting, you indulged in very plain speaking with me. I wasn't annoyed, but I am going to take the liberty of adopting the same tactics with you. Why are you selling off all your belongings like this? Why do you have these periodical fits of behaving like a frightened criminal? Why do you keep a pile of newspapers by your side dealing with a Frankfurt murder case? And who is this young man you are harboring in the house?"
"Of all the impertinence," Mr. Witt began.
"Nothing of the sort," Goad interrupted. "Friendly interest. Nothing more or less than that. If I didn't believe that I could help you, I shouldn't have said a word."
"How the devil can you or anyone else help me?" Mr. Witt groaned.
Goad settled himself a little more comfortably in his chair.
"I'll see about that when you've told me the whole story," he replied.
Mr. Witt glanced helplessly around. His visitor looked the personification of strength and self-reliance as he lounged in his chair. And for the first time, the little man ached for a confidant. He pointed towards the pile of newspapers.
"Have you read the Frankfurt murder case?" he asked.
"Every line," Goad admitted. "Rather a hobby of mine, these cases. You know that the cashier of the Frankfurt bank was murdered, and two of the bank clerks from the main office who were due to take their holiday on the following day have not been heard of?"
"Quite so," Goad agreed. "The names of the two young men are Stephen Hannaford and..."
"By Jove!"
Mr. Witt nodded shortly.
"John Eardley Witt was the name of the other one," he said. "The Eardley wraps it up a little. An uncle on my mother's side left him a small sum of money and the name. But John Eardley Witt is my son."
"You are sure that they are definitely suspected?" Goad asked.
"The newspaper seemed to be very vague about the matter."
"You are, I suppose, the sort of fellow who can keep his mouth shut?" Mr. Witt demanded.
"I have the reputation of being a safe confidant," Goad declared.
"Very well, then," the other went on. "My son is lying in Plymouth, waiting for a chance to get away to South America. Hannaford is upstairs at the present moment. That's as much as they have had of their holiday."
"The young man I saw with a pale face peering out from behind the curtains?" Goad asked.
Mr. Witt stared at him.
"Either you must have damned good eyes, or the young fellow's a bigger fool than I thought he was," he remarked sharply.
"I have the knack of observation," Goad admitted. "I picked it up early in life. It goes with my profession."
"What is your profession?" Mr. Witt inquired.
"Not that it matters what the devil you call yourself, so long as you don't call yourself an artist."
"Then we'll let my profession alone for a minute," Goad decided. "Now, get on with the story.
What's young Hannaford doing here?
He's come for money. He's been twice before.
What do they want money for? If they committed the murder, they got away with £1,500.
They daren't use it, Mr. Witt confided. It was all Bank of England notes.
How much have you parted with altogether? Goad inquired.
I have sold nearly £1,000 worth of my belongings,
Mr. Witt confessed with a little groan. My picture will have to go now.
I shouldn't let it, Goad advised. What have you done? Sold the things outright?
Pawn them, was the bitter reply.
Keep the tickets carefully. You never can tell what may happen.
Let me talk to that young man upstairs.
What on earth would be the use of that? You'd only frighten him to death.
I'd like to hear his story.
I've heard it once, Mr. Witt groaned. I don't want to hear it again. Besides, what's the good?
Look here, Goad begged. Fetch him down. Let him think I'm an old friend of the family. Things can't seem any worse to you than they do now, can they? Well, give me a chance.
I don't think he'll come, Mr. Witt said doubtfully. He's terrified if the doorbell rings.
We'll go to him, then, Goad insisted, rising.
Eventually, after a little more persuasion on the latter's part, they did so. Mr. Witt led the way upstairs and opened the door of a pleasantly furnished bedroom. Its occupant was sprawling in an easy chair with his feet upon another, smoking a cigarette, a half-empty tumbler by his side, and a decanter and siphon upon the dressing table. The windows were closed. The room was fetid with tobacco smoke. The young man, a thin, pale youth with a bad complexion and weedy figure, sprang to his feet and cowered back as he realized the presence of a stranger. He wore a blue serge suit badly out of shape and in need of brushing. He had kicked off his shoes and was sitting in his socks. His linen was not irreproachable.
"Who's this, Mr. Witt?" he demanded. "Who have you brought here?"
"An old friend, Stephen," Mr. Witt replied. "He's all right. He's not giving anything away."
"What does he want, then?"
the young man continued peevishly. Goad seated himself on the edge of the bed.
"I thought I'd like to ask you a few questions, if you didn't mind," he suggested. "I might be able to help you."
"What sort of questions?"
"About the case," Goad answered bluntly. "What made you do it?"
The young man puffed viciously at his cigarette.
"Oh, John and I were always hard up," he explained. "These banks starve us, and then they expect us to live and dress like gentlemen. I was in debt. So was John. They were bound to find it out sooner or later, and then we should have had to go. We were both out at the Frankfurt branch for some 2 months last winter. We couldn't help seeing how easy it would be. We talked about it until the idea grew on us. We couldn't think about anything else. Harrigan, the man there, was all alone, and the day we made up our minds, we knew he must have had at least £1,500. There's some big factories near with payday on Friday afternoon. Well, we just did it. That's all."
"Robbery is one thing," Goad observed. "Murder is another."
"I swear we never meant to shoot him," the young man declared, gripping the side of the chair. "Neither of us had ever handled a revolver before in our lives. We only meant to frighten him. I can swear that. John can swear it. The beastly thing went off."
"Who was holding it at the time?" Goad asked. The young man was suddenly silent.
"We've both sworn," he said, "never to tell that."
"Why do you want all this money from Mr. Witt?" Goad continued. "The passages won't cost much."
"We've had to pay several £100 to a man who saw us near Frankfurt," Hannaford groaned. "He's got to know where John is, and he's soaking us all the time. It's costing a hell of a lot, too, for John to lie low. It's a snug place, but they've got an idea we're in trouble, and they charge like the devil. With any luck, though, we'll be off next week to South America."
"Have you ever been in trouble before?"
"No," the young man snapped. "I don't know who you are, but I don't like your questions. Take him away, please, Mr. Witt. It's bad enough hanging around here while you raise the money without having strangers coming in to frighten one."
Goad rose to his feet.
"Well, it's a bad job," he admitted. "I'm afraid there's nothing anyone can do to help either of you."
"Of course there isn't," was the irritable rejoinder.
The money's what we want. The money as quick as it can be got hold of. And don't run out of whiskey, Mr. Witt. My nerves are something terrible, especially in the night. The rest of that bottle won't last long.
The two men descended the stairs in silence. Mr. Witt had lost all his peppery manner. The gleam had gone from his eyes. His mouth had weakened, was almost inclined to tremble. Goad laid his hand protectively upon his shoulder. "Look here, my friend," he said. "There doesn't seem much to be done, but I wouldn't give up hope. I shall be away tomorrow all day. I've got to run up to Barnstable. When do you expect to get the money for the things you're sending off now?"
"Not until Thursday morning at the earliest," Mr. Witt replied. "Very well, then, don't part with your young man before then. Keep him here until I come back."
Mr. Witt looked up quickly. "Anything in your mind?"
"Nothing definite. Just an idea. The great thing is not to part with a young man until I am back on Thursday."
"No fear of that," Mr. Witt sighed. "I can't get the check before then, and afterwards I'll have to go to the bank and cash it."
"Has your son written you himself at all?"
Mr. Witt shook his head.
"It wouldn't be safe," he answered with a groan. "It's a small place, this, and they'd even know his handwriting at the post office."
"I had forgotten that," Goad admitted thoughtfully. "Until Thursday, then."
Thursday was a morning of disappointment for Mr. Witt. The post brought neither the check from Exeter, which he was expecting, nor any message from his new friend, to whose return he had been looking forward with a faint, scarcely acknowledged hope of help. His breakfast was barely finished when there came a stamping on the ceiling. With a little shudder, he ascended to meet his unwelcome guest. Stephen Hannaford, in his night attire, he had just apparently scrambled out of bed, was even more unprepossessing than in the daytime. His eyes were terribly bloodshot and his hands were shaking.
"Have you got the check?" he demanded.
"It hasn't come," Mr. Witt admitted. The young man's language was such that his host covered his ears with his hands.
"You want your son to swing, do you, and me too?" the infuriated youth exclaimed. "Look here," he went on, "a promise is a promise, but if it comes to saving my neck, I'll tell you something. It wasn't I who carried the revolver, and I can prove that. It was your son who'll have to swing, not me. I may get a lifer, but he'll go to the scaffold."
Mr. Witt closed his eyes for a moment. The strain of the last few days had been great, and he was feeling giddy.
"I sent away everything I possessed of value," he announced in a dull tone. "I beg that the check should be posted yesterday. It will certainly come by the second post."
"What time's that?"
3:00.
"In time to get notes from the bank?"
"In plenty of time."
The young man crawled back into bed.
"Send me up some more tea," he directed, "and I want 2 more tins of gold flake cigarettes. Tell that tweeny of yours to look alive."
Mr. Witt turned towards the door and did the bidding of his unpleasant visitor. Afterwards, he locked himself in his own room. In his way, he was a proud man, and he had reached the limits of his endurance. No one ever knew. He scarcely remembered himself how he spent the morning. There was a pretense of lunch, a restless pacing of the room, the postman's arrival, the expected letter, and a check for £900.
"How much is it?"
Hannaford called over the banisters.
£900.
"Well, and then leg it down to the bank quick,"
the young man enjoined eagerly. "Call at the garage coming back and order the car to take me to Plymouth. There's a moon tonight. I'll get there by 4:00. Mr. Witt brushed himself mechanically, put on his hat, picked up his gloves and stick, and made his way, silent and ghost-like, through the streets of the little market town. He was scarcely conscious of the greetings he received, of the sympathetic glances his appearance provoked. He wrote out an open check and handed it across the counter together with his credit, stated his wishes in brief words, and buttoned up the pile of notes in his breast pocket. Then he turned to climb the hill again, homewards. He was brought to a standstill by the noisy clatter of an ancient Ford car and the yapping of a small white dog. Mr. Goad, looking a little tired, drew up at the side of the path. "Young man still with you?" he asked. "He is still there," Mr. Witt acknowledged, "and I've just got the money for him. He's going this afternoon." "Is he?" Goad murmured under his breath. "Well, get in, Mr. Witt. I'll drive you home." Mr. Witt mounted the car in silence. His half-wistful glance of inquiry towards Goad elicited no response. After all, what could Goad or any man do? "I've got to call at a garage," Mr. Witt announced.
"What for?"
"For a car to take the young man down to Plymouth. He hopes they'll get off on Saturday now. They've got their berths all right if they can stop this other fellow's mouth."
"We'll see about the car presently," Goad said. "There's just one word I want to have with your young friend first."
"He's in a nasty temper," Mr. Witt groaned.
"I'll humor him all right," Goad promised. He pulled up outside the gate and followed his companion into the house. The young man was waiting at the top of the staircase.
"Have you brought the money?" he demanded. "Where's the car?"
"I have the money," Mr. Witt assured him. "The car will be here presently. Mr. Goad wants one word with you."
"Blast Mr. Goad!" the young man exclaimed angrily. "I've no time for fooling about with anyone. You ought to know that."
"I shan't keep you a moment," Goad promised with spurious good humor. "Come along down to the sitting room."
Hanford descended the stairs with sullen reluctance. Goad waited until he was well inside the room. Then, with his back to the door, he advanced towards the chair into which the young man had thrown himself.
"Hold out your hands," he ordered.
"What the hell for?"
"For these," Goad replied, drawing a pair of handcuffs from his pocket.
Hanford made a dash for the door, but he was as pulp in his captor's grasp. With one hand, Goad held his wrist together, then pushed him back into the chair.
"Stay there," he directed.
"Who are you?" the young man spluttered. "What are you doing with these things?"
"I'm a detective officer, pretty well known at Scotland Yard," Goad acknowledged. "I'm supposed to be down here on a holiday, but I'm never above doing a stroke of work when necessary."
"You're betraying my trust," Mr. Witt cried bitterly. "You accepted my confidence. You gave me your word."
Goad led him to a chair.
"You sit down, my friend," he enjoined, "and don't you worry. I put the handcuffs on him to keep him quiet, but the only charge I've got against him is of obtaining money under false pretenses. When we've got the money back, we'll decide how to deal with him later."
"But the bank robbery!" Mr. Witt exclaimed.
Goad laughed scornfully. "I don't know anything about your son, Mr. Witt," he said. "I shall know more about him presently, but as regards this young man, he hasn't got the pluck to steal an old lady's reticule. The man who robbed the bank and shot the cashier will be arrested this afternoon, and I can assure you he's a very different type of person from this."
There was a moist gleam in Mr. Witt's eyes, and he was trembling violently.
Goad patted him soothingly upon the shoulder. "Look here, Mr. Witt," he explained. "It's really quite a simple matter. Your son's holiday, and this young man's, commenced the day after the murder and robbery. This was simply a coincidence. They may have started off to spend a portion of it together. That I don't know. One newspaper only spoke of two clerks being missing, a statement which was afterwards contradicted. This young man, Hanaford, thought out a very ingenious scheme. He brought you the newspaper in case you hadn't seen it, and, as I gather, confessed that he and your son had committed the robbery and shot the cashier. They have neither of them done anything of the sort. Your son, from all I can hear, is a young man in excellent repute. Our friend, who was wearing those handcuffs so gracefully, had been given notice by the manager to leave at the expiration of his holiday. Now are you getting hold of things, Mr. Witt? It seems simpler every moment, eh?
It's simple enough, Hannaford muttered. If you hadn't come blundering along, it would have worked out all right, too.
It might have, Goad admitted. Yours wasn't a bad scheme, he continued. But what should you have done if Mr. Witt's son had written to his father about his holiday or anything or come down here?
I sent a telegram in Mr. Witt's name from a village near here, the young man confessed surlily. I told him that his father had gone on a fortnight's motoring tour with a friend and would meet him at the Grand Hotel, Landedno.
Capital, Goad approved. Very ingenious indeed.
And now, what about the rest of that money?
I've spent it.
I think not. A little inconvenient for you, perhaps, but allow me to search.
Resistance was hopeless. Goad thrust his hand into the pocket of the young man's coat and drew out a packet of notes, which he laid upon the table.
All there? He asked. I'll accept 10 pounds.
Mr. Witt's elbows were upon the table. He was leaning forward, and his face was hidden in his hands. Goad patted him on the back.
Now, what shall we do with this young man? He asked. He deserves, well, God knows what he deserves.
The cat would be my idea, but I'll leave it to you. I'm the law, but I'm the law on a holiday. You've got practically all your money back. You've got the pawn tickets to recollect your treasures. Nothing will ever recompense you for the days of suffering you must have had. You can get him 12 months imprisonment, if that's any satisfaction, or you can throw him out of the house.
Mr. Witt stood up. He was already looking better. Some of the lines upon his face had gone, but there was a mistiness about his eyes which changed his whole expression.
I don't want to prosecute him, he said. Send him away. I hate the sight of him.
The young man stood up, and Goad, with an expert touch, relieved him of the handcuffs. Then, with his hand upon his collar, he marched him out of the room, marched him to the front door, and, picking him up, sent him sprawling through the rose bushes.
So, that's that, he remarked, looking in through the window at Mr. Witt. You'll like to be alone for an hour or so.
It's true, it's all true, the little man insisted.
Of course it is, Goad assured him. You know, I'm used to hearing stories and confessions. I knew there was something wrong about that young man's tale. I've been to Bristol and had an hour's talk on the telephone with the Scotland Yard since I saw you. They speak very highly of your son at the bank. And by the by, I'm expecting you to bring him to dinner tonight at the inn. He'll be here within an hour or so. 7:30. Don't trouble to change. I haven't those sort of clothes myself.
That's all right.
Goad hurried off, started up the ford, and drove down to the inn.
This is all very well, Miss Flip, he confided, but it's beginning to be a sort of busman's holiday for me.
At 7:30, Mr. Witt, his old self, bright-eyed and happy, came into the bar parlor, accompanied by a tall, sunburnt young man whom he introduced to Goad as his son. He was carrying a brown paper parcel under his arm, which for a moment, however, he ignored. The bar parlor was full, and there was a little chorus of acclamation as its occupants realized the change in their very popular neighbor. Everyone was anxious, too, to shake hands with his son.
"Gentlemen," Mr. Witt invited, "give your orders, please. I want you all to take a glass of wine with me and drink to the health of my friend here, Mr. Nicholas Goad. He's the worst painter in the world, but the best of fellows, and he has just done me a very great service." There was more acclamation, a quarter of an hour or so of good fellowship, and afterwards Goad led the way to the table in the coffee room which was laid for dinner. There was a gold-foiled bottle and an ice pail and another in reserve. Mr. Witt reverently undid the strings of the parcel which he had been carrying.
"Mr. Goad," he said. I am taking the liberty of bringing you a small present. If it has the effect upon your taste, I imagine it may have. You will perhaps change your hobby. Mr. Goad accepted the picture with a little word of protest. It was a very beautiful picture. And the more he looked at it, the more he realized the things which had been in its donor's mind. And in return, Mr. Witt concluded as they seated themselves at the table, I'm going to ask you to give me that little canvas I saw you working on the first time we met, the one with the church behind and the geese in the foreground. It's a damned bad picture, Goad acknowledged a little ruefully, but you shall have it. It's a damn bad picture, Mr. Witt agreed fervently, but I want it.
Join me next week for another case with confounding clues on The Locked Room. In the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark.